Welcome to Component 4, which, as you know, is entitled Introduction to Information in Computer Science. This unit is made up of 5 parts. Each part or segment is approximately 20 minutes in length. This is specifically Unit 7, Part 4, which has the title Networks and Networking. In this unit, we cover a number of objectives, all of which are listed in the slide in front of you. We discussed unit objectives 1 through 6 and parts 1 through 3. In part 4, we focus on concepts related to the 7th and 8th objectives listed. As usual, I'll read all of the objectives shown on the screen and then focus on the 2 that relate to this part. And so, taking it from the top, we want to gain the ability to understand the history of networks and their evolution. List and describe the various types of network communications. List and describe the various forms of network addressing, including DNS. List and define the various types of networks. Describe different network topologies. And list and describe different network standards and protocols. In part 4, we want to focus on gaining the ability to describe wireless communication and list and describe network hardware. In part 5, we'll focus on getting you gaining the ability to explain networking logical model concepts. And so, as you no doubt surmised, wireless communication happens without cabling. Signals can be sent via infrared light, which is laptop to laptop, microwave, which requires a clear line of sight between the sending and receiving device, and then by radio frequency, which is the most common method used today and is really governed by the 802.11 standard. Wireless communication seems to be everywhere in today's world, and its use is only going to grow. And so let's take a moment to look at the good, the bad, and the ugly as this relates to wireless communication. Wireless communication is growing because no cables are needed to connect devices to a network. It's a cleaner work environment since cables aren't around for people to trip on. Devices can be easily moved about. You can pick up your laptop and walk throughout a campus, for example. And it's easy for users to connect to the network if you have open connectivity. The bad part about wireless is that it can be slower than wired networks. Wireless can be slower because of signal interference and other factors. For example, a signal may not be able to fully penetrate walls, which weakens the signal. You might also have limited signal range. In other words, the farther a wireless device moves from its wireless access point, the lower the throughput. Once a device moves outside of the wireless access point's effective range, then no wireless communication can occur. In fact, in a typical home network, this is usually only about 50 feet. Approximately 15 meters. And the ugly part about wireless communication relates to security. All wireless devices have the ability to see all wireless network traffic using special software called a sniffer. Network administrators must plan for this type of activity and obviate it. If you want folks to be able to use wireless communication and not worry about whether their passwords and usernames and even data itself is stolen, then we have to plan for folks who are going to try to sniff or try to intercept electronic communications. And so, how does wireless communication happen? How does it function? Well, home wireless communication, as we've mentioned, is done by radio frequency. Radio frequencies are then mapped to specific channel numbers. In North America, channels are 1 through 13 for the technologies that are governed by the 802.11 A, B, and G standards. And you usually need the following equipment to set up wireless communication in your home. You need computers with wireless NICs. This facilitates the connection of the device to a wireless router or a wireless access point. The network needs a wireless router, and this is also known as a WAP. Then, the wireless router needs to be connected to a wired device. To get internet access, the wireless router needs a wired connection to the ISP device, for example, your cable modem router. When you set up your wireless network, it's very important that you configure the wireless access point for secure communication. One of the things that you have to set is the SSID, or the name for your wireless network. The SSID is an acronym for the Service Set Identifier. It's really the same thing as the work group name in a wired network. You should change the WAP's default password, since for any wireless device, their default password can be found on the internet. You have to supply the WAP with an IP address and subnet mask, and then ensure that the IP address and subnet mask are in a range with the computers that were and other devices that will connect to the wireless network. You should configure WPA2. WPA2 is a security protocol, and then record the code or phrase that was created for later use when we configure our wireless clients. And then finally, we need to cable the wireless access point so that it somehow connects to the ISP device. We also need to configure each wireless client. So the wireless client needs to have the same SSID that we configured on the wireless access point. The wireless client also needs an IP address and subnet mask that's in the same range as the wireless access point. Note that the wireless access point and client can't have the same IP address, although they should have the same subnet mask. And then we have to configure WPA2 using the code or phrase that we configured on the wireless access point. If you'd like more details about wireless network setup, examine the slide notes for this slide. You might pause the presentation, look at that detail, and then click when you're ready to continue on. It's important to keep in mind that standards are backwards compatible. In other words, 802.11g NICs work with 802.11a or b device-controlled wireless LANs. Wireless access points and clients must also use the same channel. We mentioned that valid channels were between 1 and 13 in North America. If a wireless access point is on channel 6 and a client is on channel 1, they will not be able to communicate with each other. Again, channel numbers correspond to an RF range. Now, channels 1, 6, and 11 frequencies do not overlap on top of each other, and so therefore in North America it's appropriate to use one of these. For example, channel 5 uses the radio frequency range of 2.421 through 2.443 gigahertz. Notice channel 6 uses the radio frequency range of 2.426 through 2.448, and we have a slight overlap. If you examine the figure on the screen, you'll see that we have a laptop or notebook connected to the wireless access point using a PC card. You'll see the PC card is plugged into the laptop. That's its wireless NIC. The wireless access point is on the table. And if you look at the back of the wireless access point between the antenna, you'll see cables that extend out the back. One of the cables is to power the access point, obviously. But the other cable is to connect that wireless access point to the wired network. And this is required if we want this laptop to be able to communicate with wired devices or even to access the internet. Typical network hardware includes networked devices, a NIC, whether you're wired or wireless, a switch, router, ISP device if we want internet access, a server if we need to manage a domain, a surge protector, and an uninterruptible power supply, which is known as a UPS. Let's look at these in more detail. Network devices are computers, laptops, printers, and scanners, and so on, that have a network-enabled operating system. For example, your computer might be running Windows 7, or Windows Vista, and even Windows XP. They need a NIC, which is going to allow them to connect to a switch or a router. And finally, cabling for a wired network. For a device to communicate on a network, it must have a NIC, or a network interface card. The hardware uses operating system services to communicate on the network. If you have a wired NIC, then this is going to require cabling and jacks, and then ultimately a switch and a router for network access and communication. A wireless NIC requires a wireless access point, and then some wired device through which the wireless access point will communicate with other wired devices. The images on the screen, starting at the left, we see a vintage 10 megabit per second Ethernet NIC for wired network communication. This old style NIC has two connector types on it. And you'll see that the connector type on the left is the old BNC type connector, and the connector type on the right is what you'd see today, where we would plug in an RJ45 jack Ethernet cable. On the right, we have a 54 megabit per second wireless PCI card, and this one relates to the 802.11g standard. One of the most important pieces of hardware in your network is the switch. Devices plug into the switch to communicate with each other. In other words, if your computer had a wired NIC installed, then you would take a network cable and plug it into your NIC, and then plug it into one of the ports shown here on the switch, the one shown here in the image. Then, any other device that's plugged into that switch would be able to communicate with your computer. The switch then plugs into an ISP device to provide internet access if that's needed. And so the image here shows a 5-port switch. Switches only allow communication between hosts sharing the same IP address and subnet mask. Switches forward traffic to devices in their network only, and this is based on the MAC address of the devices. Switches aren't routers, although expensive routers perform the actions of switches and routers, and these are known as Layer 3 switches. Switches learn the MAC addresses by reading traffic that's sent through all of its ports. And so if your computer is plugged into one of the ports on the switch, when your computer communicates, the switch itself receives that information, really intercepts it, reads the communication, and then picks up the MAC address and IP address of your computer. If the switch receives traffic for a MAC address that it knows, the switch sends that traffic to the port associated with that MAC address. If the switch receives traffic for an unknown MAC address, the switch forwards that traffic out of all of its other ports. The idea here is that that traffic will eventually make its way to a router, which will try to locate the destination network and then send the traffic there. Another important piece of hardware in your network is the router. The network boundary is defined by IP address and subnet mask numbers, as you know. The router can connect different IP addressed networks so they can communicate with each other. Routers can be wired or wireless. In fact, ISP devices are routers. A wireless access point is typically a router. The image on the screen shows a Cisco Linksys wireless router typically found in a small office home office, a so-called SOHO network. The blue Ethernet cable extending out of its rear to the right connects this wireless access point to the wired network. Now, as I mentioned, routers use IP addressing to route network traffic. Note that routers route and switches forward traffic. Routers usually have routing tables so they know where to route received traffic. Note that a switch doesn't have a routing table. It just keeps track of MAC addresses and is able to send communication to its local area network, but not to a remote network. Routers are usually configured with what's referred to as a default route, and this is the IP address of another router. In other words, if the router has no idea where a destination device is located, then it'll send the traffic to its default router. If a router receives traffic for a destination not found in the routing table, it sends that traffic to its default route. And then hopefully the default route router will know where to route this traffic. Because ultimately, if the router does not have a destination route in its routing table, and the router is not configured with a default route, the router drops that traffic. This means that the communication does not reach its destination. This might happen in a small office network, but it should not happen on a business network or on the internet. And so the image shows a small office network interconnected by an ISP router with switch ports. The ISP router connects the devices in the small home office to the internet. An ISP device, for example a cable modem router, connects either your home or your office network to the internet. You can lease these pieces of hardware from your ISP when you sign up for internet service. Sometimes you can purchase them as well. The ISP device usually has one internet port, which you connect to a wall port. They'll usually provide you with the cabling and so on that you need to connect to the ISP network. This device usually has one switch port to connect one device using an Ethernet cable. Now, you can use that port to connect to a switch, which can then connect to other devices or even other switches to extend your network. You don't need to purchase a more extensive or lease a more extensive device from your ISP to connect all of your other devices to the large network. In this case, then, all the devices share the one internet connection, which is fine. Let's look at a couple of ISP devices. The image on the left shows a Motorola cable modem router. This router uses the ISP's coaxial cable to provide internet connectivity. The image on the right shows a wireless D-Link router modem, which is used as a residential DSL gateway. And this router uses the ISP's Ethernet cable to provide internet connectivity. Another network device would be a server, which is a computer with a specialized operating system installed. Server examples are Windows Server 2008 or Windows Server 2003, the Ubuntu server, and Novell's Open Enterprise server. A server creates what we refer to as a gated community of devices and users. The server maintains a database of its objects, objects being devices and users. Restricts access to the network only to authorized devices and users, and then manages all of these. In other words, a server can indicate which users can log on to the network at which time. A server can set up rules that determines who can print to a specific printer, and so on. Servers can provide a number of functions, and these include the domain controller functionality, which is the gated community that we've been discussing, a print server, managing the printers that are part of the network, a DHCP server, which is the domain host configuration protocol server that might provide IP addresses and other information to devices, a DNS server, which is the domain naming system server, so that names can be translated into IP addresses, a file server, which might allow users to store their documents within specific folders on the hard drive of a server, a certificate server, which has to do with secure communications within a network, and then other types of functionality. If a device has a motherboard, it should be plugged into a surge protector, and then the surge protector should be plugged into the wall. Surge protectors protect devices from spikes in power, usually originating with the power company. Some power strips are also surge protectors. You need to carefully read the product information to differentiate between them. So devices need to be plugged into the surge protector to gain protection. If a power surge would occur and the device was not plugged into a surge protector, the motherboard circuitry might be destroyed. And so if your microwave device, your computer, your iPod, your iPhone, so on, are plugged directly into a wall outlet, and that wall outlet experiences a surge in power, the motherboard on any of those devices can be destroyed. And so make sure that you use a surge protector for your electronic devices, but especially for your computer, servers, printers, and so on. Protection through the use of a surge protector is measured in something known as a joule. Joules define how much electricity the surge protector can absorb without failure. You should consult an electrician if you really need to understand how many joules a surge protector should have to protect your hardware. If you want to ensure that your device does not immediately shut down due to power loss, then you should purchase and install an uninterruptible power supply, or a UPS, which provides emergency power to attach devices when power fails. A UPS provides short battery time, usually 5 to 30 minutes, depending on the devices that are attached to the UPS. A computer and monitor is fine. You can plug those directly into a UPS. Then, if your home or your office experiences a power loss, then you would be able to safely shut down your computer instead of having it abruptly shut down due to a lack of power. If you have a whole building that you need to protect against a power loss, then it might be better to have a large solution. For example, you might have a UPS in a central location, and then all electricity is connected to the UPS itself. Call centers typically have this type of a setup. As a side note, you should never plug a laser printer into a UPS. And this is because the laser printer itself, let's say that you have a laser printer plugged into a UPS, and then your house experiences a loss of power. Because the laser printer pulls so much power from a battery, and it requires so much power to operate, the laser printer will instantly drain all of the available UPS battery power, which means that you have your computer, your monitor, and a laser printer plugged into the UPS, and you lose power. All of those devices will immediately shut down because the laser printer itself will drain all of the power within a few moments, which means the UPS was essentially useless. Always plug a UPS plug a laser printer into a surge protector, and then plug the surge protector into a wall outlet. Then plug your computer, monitor, and other devices into the UPS, and then plug the UPS into another wall outlet. And finally, most UPS hardware devices also provide surge protection. Again, it's important to read the documentation to understand specifically what each device can do for you. Again, it's great to visualize surge protectors and UPS devices. The image on the top left shows a large data center scale UPS being installed by electricians. Notice the size. This means that all devices within that building would most likely be covered in the event of power loss. The bottom image shows a multi-outlet surge protector that you would purchase from any hardware store. In this case, all of the devices plug into the surge protector, and then the surge protector plugs into the wall. And the image on the top right shows a freestanding UPS. This unit in the photo has different types of connectors for input and output. And again, your computers and monitors and so on would plug into the UPS, and then the UPS would plug into a wall outlet.